Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Witt, your guest host on ID the Future today, and I'm pleased to have with me Doug Ax. He's a protein scientist. He's a professor at Biola University. He has done research work at the University of Cambridge. He got his PhD at Caltech, so he's a big heavy hitter in the intelligent design movement. He's the author of a book I very much enjoyed, Undeniable, which you can find at Amazon. It's a great book for both beginners and then going a little more in-depth. And we are giving this podcast from Texas because we're here at the Dallas Area Science and Faith Conference, and Doug is here to give a talk on his work, Undeniable. Thanks for joining me here, Doug.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, there's many different directions we could go, but I'd like to drill down into maybe just one area of your research work, which involves, as some of our listeners will know, proteins, protein folding. Darwinism, of course, makes some very grand claims about how the process of natural selection working with small random mutations was able to create all the life, all the variety of life we find around us. And you went in and said, well, let's see if the Darwinian process, the neo-Darwinian process, can even build, say, a new protein form, correct?
Correct.
Very modest. Let's start very modestly. Yeah. Just give us the brief kind of elevator explanation of what your research there at Cambridge was trying to establish.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk about proteins, to most people, that's what's in a hamburger or something like that. So these are actually sophisticated molecules or clusters of molecules within all the cells of life that are folded. They're long chains made of amino acids, and they fold into complex three-dimensional structures that enable them to do the various tasks that they do. Some of them do chemistry. They're called enzymes. Some of them are structural scaffold proteins. Some of them form the parts of machines with turning parts and all kinds of things. So they are really the molecular workhorses at the subcellular level that cause life to happen. And the question that I was wanting to address when I went and started doing my research at Cambridge University and then at the Medical Research Council Center at Cambridge was, how fussy are these sequences in the string of amino acids in terms of how precisely do you have to have them sequenced along the chain in order for them to fold and form these special three-dimensional structures? And there are thousands of these different structures that have been cataloged, tens of thousands by now. So the question was, can you just throw these amino acids together randomly and expect to get a structure, or are they much more particular than that?
Now, for some of our new listeners, just a little bit of quick background. Amino acids come in, and you can nuance anything I'm saying here that's a little fuzzy, Doug. There are 20 different amino acid letters, quote unquote, and they function a little like English letters in that you can't just throw them all together in any order and expect to have meaning, to have function in the case of proteins. So the question is, how sensitive are these proteins, these protein folds, to the order of the amino acids, the particular letters you have in any particular spot?
So it's a nice analogy to like a written sentence in English. If you want to write a sentence, you're arranging the 26 letters and a space in order to make words, in order to make phrases, in order to make a sentence that someone else can read and know what you meant to say. In the protein world, it's not letters. It's these amino acids, 20 of them, so similar to the length of our alphabet. And they have to be arranged in a sequence that's sort of like sentence length or even kind of a long sentence in some cases. And again, is it the case that you can throw these together unlike written language and get something that works? Or is it more like language where you have to know what you're doing in order to line them up? So that's the question I was approaching. And the way I did it, and you could do this with written sentences as well, is just to mess the things up. Throw in random letters and then see if the thing still works. And if you did that with written sentences, you would find that it wouldn't work. Or you could find that if you had a long enough sentence that you can know the context, you could mess up a small part and people could interpolate. But I took all of that into account in doing work on proteins and started with a protein that was just barely readable, if you will, and then messed up chunks of it and found out how particular those chunks are to the arrangement of the letters within each one. And when you do that, you can get a number, actually. You can actually find out what fraction of these things work. And by sampling different parts of this protein fold, I came up with a number that's frighteningly rare. So 1 in 10 to the 77th power. So that's, if you want to write that number out, it'd be 1 in a number that would be written as 1 followed by 77 zeros. Something like a trillion, 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 trillion combinations would have to be tried at chance to get one that would work.
Right. So we're multiplying a trillion times a trillion. So, so 1 in a billion is chump change compared to these long odds.
Yeah.
There, what, how many, there's something like 10 to the 80 atoms in the whole universe, 10 to the...
So this is, it's around that size.
Yeah,
it'd be like marking a single atom in the known universe and expecting someone to randomly thrash about and pull out that atom and get it.
Now, and you publish this, these on your Twitter account, right? That's the, really the only place
you
ever...
Exactly, pre-Twitter, so I just wrote it on the bathroom wall.
No, joking, because you actually got this in a very prestigious science journal. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I went through rigorous peer review and appeared in 2004 in a journal that's called the Journal of Molecular Biology, which is really kind of the... It's a very well-respected, original molecular biology journal. It's not a flashy journal like Science and Nature, but it's actually more, in my opinion, you don't get the best science in those flashy journals. You get the best science in kind of the well-respected journals like that. The editor in charge was the head of the European Bioinformatics Institute. That is the editor in charge of the review of my manuscript. So it went through very rigorous peer review.
Okay, so that's important background for an objection that I've recently ran across, and I'll briefly summarize it. There's no way Doug could have sampled all the different possible letter combinations. There's something like, 10 to the 77 combinations. He couldn't possibly have sampled those all, and so he must just be kind of filling it in with guesswork, and so therefore his results are invalid. How would you respond to that objection?
Okay, and I can't correct it because I haven't heard that directly. I'm just going to take the argument from you.
How did you get around this challenge? It's a
very fundamental tool in the sciences is sampling. When you have too many things to look at all of them, and there's all kinds of sciences where that's the case, what you do is you try to, without bias, choose a number that you can look at, and that gives you some information about the population that you're sampling. So this is just basic scientific principle. If we want to know how rare or common a certain maybe gene type is in the human population, and there are how many billion, 6 billion humans on the planet, you don't have to look at all 6 billion genomes. You just make sure that you sample in different parts of the world in a non-biased way. So you're just grabbing people at random, as it were, and you check them. And if you did, say, 1,000 of those, you'd get a very reasonable estimate for what the prevalence of this gene is within the whole billions. You don't have to look at all the billions.
It's roughly similar principle to polling. You don't have to
poll
every American to get within, 3, 4, 5% points.
Right, and it does have the caveat that you want to make sure that you're sampling in an unbiased way.
Unbiased,
so if you want to know, how many people support a particular person to be a presidential candidate, you don't want to go into a room where they're having a party
for that candidate, right?
or for the opposite. Yeah, you'll get a very... There's ways that you can do it wrongly. But if you understand that caveat, sampling is a very, very powerful way.
So you were careful about that. Evidence of that is that the editors of the Journal of Molecular Biology, the people you were working under at Cambridge as you were assembling this, presumably, most or all of whom were probably pro modern evolutionary theory, had no reason to try to support or unfairly benefit a study that would be a black eye for neo-Darwinism. None of them had a problem with the way that you did your research. Is that correct?
And it's presumably the opposite, that this was a piece of work that challenged orthodox thinking in some ways,
right,
and yet they found it to be solid.
Right. If they would have loved to have found something that was weak in your research, but instead they looked it over carefully, and it eventually was published in this very prestigious journal. So that's encouraging. For those of us that do not have the level of mathematical and chemistry science background to be able to be certain, it's interesting to be able to point to these sources that said, this was solid. There's, of course, other evidence that, and maybe I'll get into that when I interview Michael Behe later, there's other sources of evidence that the Darwinian mechanism can only do so much, that as we look at things like malaria and HIV and E. coli to see what they've been able to do as they mutate. Some interesting things, but in some ways very modest things. So there's, it looks to me, would you say there's a kind of convergence of evidence from different angles suggesting that there are severe limits to what blind, unguided processes can do?
Yes, absolutely. It's not that it does nothing. It's that what it does is very small scale and modest. It doesn't invent new things, is the way I put it. You can get tweaking of things that exist, and sometimes that tweaking is very significant. For example, every year I go and get a flu shot, and that's because every year influenza virus goes through enough mutations that the coat proteins become different enough that the antibodies I had from the last time I got the flu probably won't work on the next season's flu. So that's an example of a true evolutionary process that has epidemiological significance and clinical significance. And there are lots of examples like this in disease, but nothing new is being invented. The parts of the influenza virus are the same as they were 1,000 years ago. It's not inventing anything new. It's just kind of changing its camouflage.
Right. Microevolution rather than macroevolution.
Correct. That's another way to put it. Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you, Doug. Good luck with your talk this afternoon. We're glad to have you here in Texas. And for those of you that were impressed by how clearly Doug summarized his complex arguments, I encourage you to go find his book, Undeniable, at Amazon. It's an excellent read. I've read it and can vouch for that. It's got some fantastic reviews, too, from scientists. That's Undeniable.
That's not the Bill Nye.
Bill Nye. Though, feel free to read the Bill Nye because you'll see how ridiculous those arguments are and how solid Doug's are. Well, thank you, Doug.
Thank you for having me.
For ID the Future, this has been Jonathan Witt. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.